There was an extraordinary interview last night that was posted between Lex Fridman and Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine. In this interview, I think we had, it was an extensive one. It was like 3 hours, a little over 3 hours. And they touched on all kinds of topics from NATO, from the conduct of the war to how the Trump administration may negotiate the thing to an end, what kind of outcome he wants, et cetera. Really a broad-based thing. And one of the things that I think kind of is the big takeaway is that we saw very clearly how Zelensky mentally views the situation. And that is so important because when you hear some of the things he says and you understand his overarching mentality and the framework with which he sees how he perceives reality, that'll tell you a lot about what we can expect when the Trump administration actually does take power less than 3 weeks from today. And to try and make some sense of this and to put it in layman's term, we have back the great Doug McGregor. Been a while since we've had him on here, CEO of Our Country, Our Choice, highly decorated combat veteran and great analyst. Doug, first of all, welcome to 2025 and welcome back to the show.
Yeah, it begins whether we want to begin it or not.
It truly does. And this interview here, I don't know if you've had a chance to, I'm sure you haven't seen all of it. It's quite a long deal, but I watched a number of pieces of it. And I just wonder, even before we start with some of the specific segments of that interview, what your impression was about Zelensky? Is he promoting something that has even a little bit of a chance of success?
No, I don't think he believes that he has any chance to succeed whatsoever. We'll have to listen to Sersky, and obviously your audience will make their own minds up about what he's doing and why he's doing it. The war is lost. It's been lost for some time. And the great tragedy here is that no one in Washington wants to admit that. And now, sadly, we hear from the Trump administration that he intends to continue providing aid to Ukraine, ostensibly because he thinks if he stops it, that will somehow or another de-incentivize the Russians to come to the table and do what he wants. The truth is, they're not coming to the table to do anything he wants. In fact, they don't really need him to end the war. So I think we're in very difficult territory right now, and Zelensky has got one eye on what's happening on the battlefield and another eye on his escape pod that will carry him to safety in the West, where he's piled up billions in cash.
Well, we'll certainly see if he's able to make it to that pod, if that's in fact what he's thinking. But one of the things that really jumped out at me right away when I was watching this interview was at least what Zelensky is saying, and I'd like your view on the backside of this, how much you think he believes this stuff, because it looks to me like he actually believes it, or how much he may be just saying it to try to butter up Trump, so to speak, and to make him, you know, positively inclined towards what Zelensky may want to try to do. But in this clip here, he's going to talk about a number of things about that he wants to end the war. So he does want the war to end, but the terms that he is going to lay out there are a little curious. But the one, what he apparently thinks, and pardon the pun, his Trump card, is that he thinks Vladimir Putin is afraid of Donald Trump.
I want to end the war. We want a lasting peace for Ukraine. We must do this, the ceasefire, exchange people, and then diplomatically return all territories. And we will do this through diplomacy. What will happen next with President Trump? If the ceasefire happens without security guarantees, at least for the territory we control, what does he get? If he manages to make a ceasefire deal, and 3 months later, Putin launches a new wave of attacks. What will Trump look like? What will Ukraine look like? What will everyone look like? Putin will just do it. And why would Putin do it? Because today, he's afraid of Trump. But once Trump manages, for example, to do a ceasefire deal without serious security guarantees for Ukraine, he will give a pass to Putin. Not that he wants to. No, he does not want that. I believe in what he says. But he will give Putin an opportunity. Because in Putin's head, he wants me to fight with Trump. Putin's plan is to end the occupation of our territory. This is in his sick head.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack in that one there. Let's start off with the kind of the big headline there that Putin is afraid of Trump. How do you see that?
I think the notion that the Russians regard Donald Trump as a crazy person who will reach for the nuclear trigger and start a major war is nonsense. I don't think they see any evidence for that at all, and I don't think President Trump has given them any reason to believe that. I think their concern is similar in some respects, but fundamentally different from what Zelensky said. The Russians want this to end, absolutely. They've always been open to negotiations, always willing to sit down and talk. But they want something more than just the neutrality of whatever remains of Ukraine. They want a new modus vivendi in place. In other words, a new structure for national security for Russia and the security of NATO member states. Agreements regarding forces, how many will be stationed, where they will go, where they will move. And you know, Dan, we had these agreements with the Russians previously. The mutual balance force reduction talks led to a set of agreements that actually made a great deal of sense, where we would inform the Soviets of when we were going to come, when we were going to go, and they would do the same thing. I don't think it's unreasonable or irrational at all for the Russians to demand that. Zelensky knows that he's on borrowed time. It's amazing that President Trump would have stepped back from simply ignoring the man completely and agreed to continue aid to Ukraine. Remember, this is the same president said, I can end the war in 24 hours. Well, you could certainly end the fighting in 24 hours, and he could do that by simply suspending aid and pulling us out of Ukraine. All Americans in and out of uniform leave Ukraine immediately. That would send a very powerful signal to everyone that it's over. But he's not doing that. Instead, he's grudgingly going along with this stupid idea of pouring more dollars and more equipment down the rat hole.
But you know, Doug, I keep hearing that a lot of commentary about people speculating that that's what Trump's going to do. But I mean, Biden administration just like shoveled everything out the door before leaving office. And there was like many billions of dollars of equipment and drawdown equipment, et cetera. Is there a lot more stuff that Trump can even give?
Oh, of course, he can continue to fund this mafia state called Ukraine, because Zelensky is really in charge of an organized crime state. Everybody everywhere in that state is stealing cash, stealing something for resale. 50% of everything we've sent to Ukraine, according to the inspector general in a number of reports, is usually either resold on the black market or simply ends up in people's pockets. Look, you've been down this road before. We've got lots of battalion commanders and brigade commanders in the Ukrainian army who are not accurately reporting casualties because the government doesn't want to pay the widows. They're pocketing the excess cash that comes down to pay soldiers to put it into their own pockets. The Ukrainian army is in the process of dissolution. People are leaving. Well, why would you stay? I mean, you're essentially being treated like a serf in the 18th century in Tsarist Russia. You're told to show up and die for whatever the master tells you to do. This is a horrible situation for Ukrainians. I don't think Zelensky has a leg to stand on, and I think if we remove the security apparatus that protects him, which is British, French, and American, but largely British and American, I don't think Zelensky would last 5 minutes. You know, so this is all theatrics. Well, no meaning, no value, should be ignored largely.
Adding to the theatrics, and I think in an attempt to divert attention away from the topic you just mentioned about the corruption, in this conversation, Zelensky said, actually, well, and let me just preface this. You may actually agree with part of what he says right here, because Zelensky's saying the corruption is not from me, it's from somewhere else.
During all this time of the war, around $177 billion have been voted for or decided upon. $177 billion. Let's be honest. We have not received half of this money. The second point, which is very important just as an example, is it corruption? The first question, Whose corruption? This is the second. As a president, I had cargo jets. And I asked America to give me the opportunity to use our jets for transfer, not to pay a lot. To whom? To your companies, to American companies. No, I didn't get this opportunity. My jets stayed put. And the United States jets, cargo jets, move these weapons. But everywhere you have to spend money. So we could get more weapons, but we have to pay for this very expensive fleet. My question, is this corruption or not? Or lobbyism? What is it?
Now, I don't, you know, obviously he can say all day long that they don't have the corruption that you just detailed on the inside there. But I think that in a narrow sense, some of his truth to what he said about the fact that some on the U.S. side are making sure that the most expensive means to get some of this aid over there puts lines pockets in the U.S.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that. It's rather entertaining, though, because this is something like the pot calling the kettle black. But let's face it, we know that the Hill and the so-called military-industrial congressional complex is heavily engaged in laundering money, moving pots of money from one place to the other. And in return, major campaign donations flow in, and corporations provide jobs in districts and states. And all of this is bound up together with the Department of Defense and this enormous $1 trillion defense industry that we've got that we can't audit. So thanks, Zelensky, for telling us something we know. But the point is that what's left over is squandered and is resold and is misappropriated. He doesn't want to admit that he's in charge of a mafia state, but that's essentially what it is. That's why the first thing that President Trump needs to do is cut it off. Stop the flow of money. This is why people voted for President Trump in 2016, because it was very obvious to everybody that what he was promising to do was stop the money from flowing. That's why everyone like Mitch McConnell and Schumer and the rest, all members of what we now know to be the Uniparty, opposed him. And today, President Trump is coming back into effectively the same, if not worse situation, frankly.
I want to shift gears a little bit to the went back to the conversation there where Lex was asking about one of the central features of what Zelensky is trying to get, what many in the West are trying to foist, and what Russia has been standing against. Let's look, first of all, at what Zelensky talked about regarding NATO.
To make it clear, let's describe the idea that you are speaking about. I would like to offer you other ideas too, but right now, your idea is that NATO accepts Ukraine minus the five regions of Luhansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia, Kherson, and Crimea.
Just so you understand the situation, the invitation to NATO is legislatively issued to Ukraine. So to us, all those territories are still Ukraine. But NATO so far can only act in the part that is under Ukrainian control. This can be negotiated. I am sure about that. Yes, this would not be a great success for us. But if we see a diplomatic way to end the war, this is one of the ways.
Now, he's repeated something there he said in that first clip that I showed, that where he said that they want to diplomatically get back all of our territory. So he's, in his mind, he wants some kind of a negotiated settlement that ends the war where it's at. Sure, Russia's going to control some for now, but we're going to get security guarantees from the United States. We're going to get NATO membership here, and then later on, we're going to diplomatically get that back. Now, what no one wants to talk about, and I'd like you to elaborate on, is on what planet would anyone on the Russian side agree to any of that?
None that I'm aware of. I mean, what incentive is there for the Russians to create a situation which would allow the regrowth of the metastasizing cancerous tumor that we've turned Ukraine into? I don't see it. I think this is all nonsense. The Russians are going to call their bluff. if we send over Kellogg and whoever else goes with him with these ridiculous things about ceasefire lines and then negotiations on terms that allow Ukraine in 10 years or 20 years to become a member of NATO, which frankly, I don't think will be around in 10 years, if it's even around in 5 years. That sort of thing is going to go nowhere. What he's saying is going to go nowhere. Russia will retain control of the ground and territory it currently occupies. And I think that territory is going to expand. I think we may see offensive operations to the south into Odessa, certainly consolidate control over Kursk and territory to the north. If you're a Russian right now and you look at your history and you look at your experience since this war began, it's very hard to argue against a line that does not largely conform to the Dnieper River. That would make sense for them. Now, remember that BlackRock is expecting to exploit the living daylights out of mineral resources, oil, gas, agriculture, and everything else. They're not the only ones. I'm sure Larry Fink has a number of people lined up to go in there and essentially cash in on prostrate, comatose Ukraine. But it's not going to work very well. Mr. Putin is not going to turn everything over to Larry Fink and his friends. The Russians understand the game. They know what they're dealing with Zelensky. I think they're going to continue to press to the west. And the only way this stops is if, again, President Trump just says, look, I've had it. I didn't start this war. This was never my idea. I oppose it. I am ending all aid, military aid to Ukraine immediately. I am withdrawing all U.S. citizens in and out of uniform from Ukraine immediately. Then it would probably make sense for him to start withdrawing forces from Poland and Romania, because they're just wasting time, money, and resources over there. They're not going to go to war. We don't want to go to war with anybody. So let's get them out and bring them home. I think eventually these things will sink in. But right now, Mr. Trump is bowing to pressure from people who are in government, from people that he's surrounding himself with, who want this to continue. And many of them are the same people who want to sponsor, continuously sponsor, what I call unrestricted arson in the Middle East. Burn down everything, destroy everything, destabilize everything, all in the name of making Israel bigger, greater, stronger. It's not going to turn out well for anybody in the region, certainly not for Israel this way, but it's the same group of people. They're all part of the same formula. I don't know what President Trump's going to do. It's a bad situation because it's not going to help him. It's not going to satisfy his base. It's not going to make his supporters happy. It's going to put the United States at great risk.
Here's what I think is one of the problems that Trump is going to have to deal with, because there has been a number of people who claim to be on Trump's side, who claim to be in his inner circle or whatever, are saying that, yes, we want to talk, negotiate some tough deals with Putin, because, yeah, he is afraid of him. And so if Putin doesn't agree to the Kellogg plan, then we're going to put more pressure on him. We're going to, increase. You may remember Gorka when he was first announced as being part of the Trump administration. He said that, that won't be peanuts what the whole Biden had done for what we'll do if you don't give in to what we're asking for. But in contradiction or contrast to all that, you have the Russians saying, first of all, a couple of days or a week or so ago, Lavrov just categorically said there's not going to be a ceasefire. There won't be, because all that does is help the other side. We're not interested in that at all. We're interested in a negotiated settlement. Regarding the NATO thing, Putin was much more direct.
I don't know what they are saying right now in the new upcoming team of the next American president, but in 2021, President Biden back then proposed exactly that. He said that they would postpone the accession of Ukraine to NATO for the next 10 years because it was not ready. And I responded, yes, it wasn't ready, but what you will do is you will prepare it and then make it part of NATO. So it's actually not that long of a period. For us, it doesn't matter whether it's 1 year or 10 years. In historical terms, that's not so much. And I don't know if that is the true opinion of the Trump's team. But what's the difference between the proposals that you shared right now and the proposals of Biden's old administration? I don't know how the situation is going to develop going further.
So here's what I want to ask you specifically, Doug, is if Trump and his advisors, or some of his advisors anyway, are pushing in one way, like we just mentioned here, about put pressure on them and get a good negotiation, et cetera. But then you got Russia categorically saying, we're not going to do any of those things. And if Trump comes in and even tries to do that, to pump up stuff, but it doesn't change the realities on the ground, that's going to put Trump in a tough position to where he could, if he keeps going down that path that the money people want him to, our side could physically lose the war. And I think that would be worse than Trump actually giving away. But at the other side, if Trump comes in and does what you suggest, especially early, and just withdraws our support, withdraws our people, he will be crushed in politically by people saying, oh, you just surrendered. You're a surrender monkey to Putin. How does he navigate that?
Well, first of all, he needs to ignore the foolish statements by people that have cost this nation untold quantities of blood and treasure. Remember, he wasn't elected to extend wars into the uncertain future. Let's step back from the Ukraine situation a little bit and look at Europe. The German government has collapsed. Eventually, and I don't think this will happen immediately, but eventually, new leadership that is nationalist will come to power in Berlin. We've already listened to Alisa Weidel, and she has made the case that neither NATO nor EU, for that matter, are necessarily in Germany's interests. She is correct. Germany is not some sort of serfdom or slave state to be moved about as we decide. The Germans need to get over the post-World War II hangover and reinvigorate their minds and understand that they have a very powerful and productive role to play in Europe to maintain the peace in Europe, which is exactly what Bismarck set out to do when Germany was unified. I think we're going to see more of that. That means the Germans are going to get out of this nonsense. The same thing is true, I think, in Paris. Once you begin looking at the polling data, listening to the people that are discussing the future of France, there's no future for what Macron stands for. That's a dead end. His state is just as stricken with debt as ours is. The era of promising everybody, everywhere, everything for nothing is ending. The so-called New Deal is no longer a fair deal or a viable deal. It's dead. England is in very serious straits. I'm surprised that Starmer is still walking around in charge. I think he's going to be kicked out. So if you look at Europe right now, they're prepared to launch on their own, regardless of what we do and what we say. And the most important state in Europe today is the same state that's been the most important state in Europe for decades, Germany. And Germany has had it. I mean, after all, they have us to thank for the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline. They have us to thank for the deindustrialization of Germany. You know, and if you're looking for puppets who are pathetic, amoral buffoons, you have Olaf Scholz and his sidekick, Annalena Baerbock. These people are done. They're finished. They're on their way out. They'll be lucky to survive in the next 10 years, depending upon what happens in Germany. When the rage, the full picture of corruption and destruction reaches the German people, there's going to be hell to pay in Germany. You're going to have the same thing in France. You're going to have the same thing in Great Britain. So President Trump has to look beyond the buffoonish characters that he's got around him. He's got to look into the future and understand this is not 1965, 75, 85, or 95. This is a new world.
Yep.
Forget all of this, unipolar moment nonsense, which was never real anyway. And stop worrying about, are the Americans as a people going to be upset if they acknowledge that we are not a supreme power everywhere on the planet? They don't give a damn. Get back to basics. Americans care about what's happening here at home. They don't give a damn about Ukraine. Pack your stuff. Get out. Get everybody out of Poland and the Baltic states. Come home. Let the Germans and others negotiate an end to this with Putin, because, listen, they're the ones that have to live with this. How many times do we have to tell people Americans don't live in Europe? We live in the Western Hemisphere. We're worried about our borders. We're worried about millions, tens of millions of foreigners inside our country who are not legally here, who are responsible at least partially for the tremendous increase in criminality. All of this has to be taken seriously. Get the troops back, put them on the border, prepare for the hard work that needs to be done here at home. Forget this nonsense overseas.
Well, we'll see if he ends up doing that. But one of the things that's going to, I think that potentially is going to complicate things, depending on what Trump does, if he takes your advice here. But you see that in the last piece of the Lex interview with Zelensky, which shows, in my view, the real detachment from the real world. So Lex, to his credit, tried several times during this interview to say, hey, I hear your vision about how you would like this to go, and about, you know, NATO security guarantees, future, all get your diplomacy to get your stuff back. I get all that. But you also have reality to contend with. And if you're not willing to talk to Russian President Vladimir Putin, then how is this going to work out? Here's what he said.
More sanctions. It's okay. To take off sanctions.
It's okay with you, but it's not going to be okay with the president of Russia.
Yes, but I'm not thinking how it will be very good for him. He's still a killer.
I understand, but unfortunately, the reality is that a compromise is needed in order to reach an agreement.
In your understanding, the fact that he is no in jail after all the murders, he is not in jail assuming all the murders, and no one in the world is able to put him in his place, send him to prison. Do you think this is a small compromise?
This is not a small compromise, and to forgive him will not be a small compromise.
To forgive? No one will forgive. This is absolutely impossible to forgive him.
Okay, I can get why Zelensky and many Ukrainians would hate the Russians. That's not hard to understand at all. But if you're not even willing to, in a conversation, acknowledge it, but you have to hold your nose and make a deal. Otherwise, you know, the war won't come to an end. So my question to you, though, Doug, is if Zelensky sticks with this plan and if Trump sticks with what's claimed as being their intention to try to put pressure on Russia, what's going to happen on the battlefield? What are the Russians going to do?
The Russians are going to continue to move west. From their standpoint, they know what you and I just discussed about Europe. That the European portion of this equation, the European variable in this equation, is going to fall away. I mean, let's get real. Are we going? Somebody said to me the other day, well, what about the Lithuanians, the Latvians, and Estonians? And I said, well, I like them. They're very nice people. What do you want us to do about it? Well, we have to protect them. No, we don't. We need to protect Kansas, Missouri, Arkansas, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Oregon, Washington, Pennsylvania, New York. We're not in the business of protecting these other places. And if they're smart and they know how to do business, they know damn well they don't need to be protected from the Russians because the Russians are not interested in invading them. This is all nonsense. Zelensky should be much more concerned about his future and the things that he has done, because once that word gets out, just as we saw recently, journalists in France and elsewhere have come forward and exposed this terrible lie about Bucha in Ukraine, the supposed, atrocity committed by Russian troops. Never happened. Now they're trying to say, well, these were foreign mercenaries in the Ukrainian army that did this. I'm skeptical. But we have seen the SBU. We know what the Ukrainian secret police is capable of. They're very much like the NKVD under Stalin. Ukrainians killed these people in a desperate attempt to drag us in. This is not the first time. It's another false flag to get the Americans upset, to capture time on television. And the people that want us in Ukraine also are the people that control the mainstream media. And as a result, we're fed this sort of steady diet of lies and misinformation. Zelensky belongs in jail, at least until we can put together a plan to execute the man, because he's a criminal of the worst kind. And he has consigned Ukraine to destruction. He's done more to kill Ukraine as a state than anyone else on the planet.
Wow, that's a pretty tough position there.
Well, definitely listen, look at this man. I mean, this is the man that's dragging teenagers and old men off the street to go fight the Russians. Come on, this is ridiculous. It makes no sense. This is the man that has lied to everyone about the Rus- what the Russians have not done. Now, in every war, there is excess, excess killing of various kinds. But the notion that the Russians have deliberately committed atrocity after atrocity after atrocity is a lie. He knows it, but it's in his interest to push the lie. And why is it in his interest? Because we're paying him handsomely to do it. This needs to stop. Cut off the money. That's the message for President Trump. Cut off the money.
Well, that would certainly cause that would certainly have that result. There's no question about it. Last thing I want to touch on this topic here before we shift over to the Middle East is some of the news that's coming out in the last 36 hours, and that is a so-called new offensive in the Kursk area. And Gary, if you can bring that map up there in the really for the Institute for the Study of War, they posted this map earlier today, which shows that that green circle in the upper right hand corner by Bolshoye Soletskoye. Sorry if my pronunciation is off there. There was at least what's being reported is about a company sized operation of 20 some odd tanks and armored personnel carriers that achieved, went into a certain area, actually a small village, went forward. All the media in the U.S. And actually the West is talking about this big new offensive, and it's causing all these problems. This morning, somebody you're going to love here, Ben Hodges seems to think that this is actually something really good for the Ukraine side.
This shows a real understanding of the operational level of warfare by the Ukrainian general staff. By launching this attack, it continues to present dilemmas for the Russian general staff. Do they have to pull resources now from another part of the war to address Kursk? Because obviously what they've done so far is not enough. And I've heard that Russian mil bloggers are complaining that Russia does not have adequate reserves in the region. This to me is astounding. The third takeaway, of course, is this complicates things for the Russian side if they are thinking about some sort of negotiated outcome where they get to keep what they have, because obviously Ukraine controls a significant part of the Kursk Oblast.
Now, that's interesting. And before I get you to comment on that, that's a retired three-star general who used to be in command of all U.S. Army forces in Europe. That's his view of what happened there. Here is a YouTube blogger who has a different view.
According to the report of the Group of Forces North, the Russians managed to take under control more than half of the settlement of Makhnovka. Some sources reported that the village of Dmitrykov and the village of Makhnovka, villages of Dmitrykov and Makhnovka, were captured by the Russians completely. And also we have different updates from different mappers showing us some improvements on the ground. So once again, while the Ukrainians are trying to attack regular FPV drones. Once again, according to the Group of Forces North, the settlement of Leonidovo was captured by the Russians completely. As for the south and outskirts, the Russians also managed to improve their positions, and also according to the report of the Group of Forces North, the Russians managed to take under control more than half of the settlement of Makhnovka. Some sources reported that the village of Dmitrykov and the village of Makhnovka, villages of Dmitrykov and Makhnovka, were captured by the Russians completely. And also we have different updates from different mappers showing us some improvements on the ground. So once again, while the Ukrainians are trying to attack the settlement of Bolshoye Soldatskoye, the Russians are attacking the city of Sudzha itself, and the Russians are trying to take under control the village of Malaya Lokhnya.
So while you have General Hodges trying to say that there's like some real significance to this, you have the mill blogger showing that, look, that didn't even slow Russia down. They're still penetrating into it, that they're going to eventually just cut that off and it's all going to die. There's no negotiating. It may be an embarrassment for Putin, maybe. But again, Doug, it's a company size element. It's not even a brigade. What do you make of it?
Well, Hodges is in the business of pointing to molehills and trying to convince everyone that they are mountains. This is just, you know, food for the Western media. Pitch this to the journalists and tell them, well, Ukraine has got lots of life in it. Ukraine can still win this war. Here's your evidence. It's all nonsense. It might be useful to point out that Shortly after Appomattox in April 1865, there was a battle in Texas. In fact, you may be familiar with it, Dan, since you're from that neck of the woods. And I think it was under General Kirby Smith, the Confederate commander, and they fought a Union force somewhere near the Red River, I think, and they defeated the Union force. The war was already over. It was over because Lee had surrendered. And Lee's surrender marked the end of it. In other words, there were places where the Confederates could still occasionally make inroads, but on the whole, the South was starving. It was prostrate. It couldn't manufacture arms. It was short on ammunition, and it was short on manpower. You have a similar situation today in Ukraine. Ukraine is very much in a condition similar to what the South was facing at the end of the Civil War. That's why this man, Zelensky, should be considered a criminal. He's causing unnecessary carnage and death. He's not interested in Ukraine. He wasn't appointed to his position or elected to his position to do anything for Ukraine. He was there and promised that he would end up as a billionaire, or at least a 100 millionaire, if he waged war on Russia to the bitter end. And that's what he's doing. He has nowhere else to go. There's nowhere else he can hide and live other than under protection of the United States and the West.
You know, that it's ironic, and I mean, the reality of it is whether you know what you're talking about happens, whether he gets, you know, captured or whatever, put in jail, etc. I mean, for him to continue the fighting, at some point they'll just lose. And so everyone will see that all the stuff he's been saying throughout the war, especially from, say, 2023, January 2023 onward, he was promising them to get back their 1991 borders. He said they're going to win the offensive, and now then they're going to win this great negotiated settlement that's on their terms, even though they're on the bottom side. All that will be shredded by the Russian army. They'll be showing on there. Or he'll finally come to reality and say, we're going to make a negotiated settlement. And then all of his people are going to go, then why did we fight for the last 2 years and all these promises? And then I think the risk is really high that his people could turn against him.
Well, I think they've already turned. He's living on borrowed time. He has very good security around him. I think the British in particular done a brilliant job of securing him. And he's working for the Russians, because the longer he dithers, the longer he sacrifices Ukrainian lives for nothing, the further west the Russians move. So I think by the time we go to the inauguration on 20 January, I suspect most of the Russian force will close in on the Dnieper River and will be looking at the offensive operations that I mentioned earlier. There's no reason not to do that if you're a Russian at this point, for the very reason we discussed at the beginning. Do you want this to reoccur? See, sadly, we seem to have people in charge in Washington who are perfectly delighted to see this reoccur again and again and again. I don't think the Europeans fall into that category at all. And that's why the split between the United States and Europe is coming. It's going to be profound. And the most important state in Europe, Germany, it will have new leadership, and they will turn back to Russia, which historically was really their ally. Not only their business partner, but their ally. World War I, World War II, they were anomalies in history. In the 300 years of Russo-German relations, the Russians and the Germans got along famously, particularly the Prussians in northern Germany. So this is where we're headed. These old cultural means, in other words, if you want to know what a country is going to look like in 10 years, look at the countries around it. If you want to understand the resilience of culture, look at the culture in the country and the culture in the states that border it. We've had these discussions in the Middle East. You want to know what Iraq or Syria are going to look like eventually? Look at the states around them. We have learned nothing. Americans don't understand this. And that's why American citizens have said, enough. We don't need this. Get out.
One last thing before I shift gears here a little bit, because you said something that I'd like you to explain a little bit, because you said that potentially by the time that Trump is inaugurated, which is less than 3 weeks from now, that the Russians could be on the Dnieper. What do you say to those people who say, well, look, I mean, you see how long it's taken them, you know, even since they captured Avdiivka earlier this year, just to get up to the gates of Pokrovsk. But how would they get past all that and rapidly increase their rate of advance when they haven't done it so far?
Well, keep in mind that there's not much to face them now, Dan. They can move almost with impunity. Putin has been very sensitive to Russian casualties. You know, whenever you talk to Russians, they'll all point out, well, this we've always fought wars on the backs of our soldiers, sacrificed thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands to gain ground. Well, that's true, but President Putin, to his credit, has not done that. He's tried to maximize the use of firepower to eliminate as much as possible the opposition in front of his forces. They have the logistics in place. They've had a huge buildup and preparation to move further west. So I'm confident they can do that. But they're going to do it in a way that minimizes unnecessary loss of life. And by the way, the Ukrainians who surrender, the Ukrainian troops, foreign or otherwise, that surrender, are being very well treated. They know that. And they have welcomed these people into their territory, that is the Russians, and fed them, clothed them, given them medical support and aid. There's no danger of them being mass executed, which, of course, has happened to Russians in Ukrainian control. So this thing is going to end. It'll end favorably for Russia. And I think the key to it is Europe and the European attitude towards what's happening. Because in the United States, the average American doesn't understand this, is not really interested. It's really a small group of people inside the Beltway that have hijacked our government, hijacked our foreign and defense policy, hijacked everything. Yeah, How else would you explain open borders to the South? If that had ever been put to a vote by the American people, I seriously doubt they'd have gotten 20% support. So right. President Trump just needs to understand that this is not macho time. This is not a time to measure how big his is versus how big Putin's is. It's nothing to do with it.
Yeah,
this is not our issue.
Well, that's exactly right. I'm hoping that he will, you know, focus on the things that really do matter to the people who put him in office. Interestingly enough, we actually at 2 o'clock today, at the end after we do this show here, we're actually going to have somebody who's been fighting on the Russian side, Aidan Menis, who's a former British person who's fighting for the Russians. He's going to tell us a lot about what it looks like on the Russian side there. But before we get to him, I want to talk about some other things that I think that you've been talking about are a lot important that aren't really on the headlines these days, but that may jump in there. And that's in the Middle East. First of all, obviously, a lot of focus has been on Israel with the Hamas, with the Hezbollah, and then everybody's been focused on Syria and how it collapsed, et cetera. But no one's been paying much attention to other things going on in the region. I want to look at two. One is Egypt, which is kind of not even been on the radar for most Americans, but that Sisi apparently is in growing risk of potentially facing a popular uprising, revolution, or even the emergence of political activism aimed at internal regime change. What do you think of what's going on in Egypt?
Dan, I'm so glad that you are mentioning Egypt. Egypt is, the elephant in the corner. You're talking about a nation of almost 100 million, maybe a little more. Egypt is enormously important to us strategically. It's the linchpin and much of our strategy for North Africa and the Middle East. We've worked tirelessly to keep Sisi in power. Remember, General Sisi took over at a point in time when it looked like the Muslim Brotherhood was going to dominate and run the country. And of course, the Muslim Brotherhood across the Middle East reports to Mr. Erdogan in Turkey. And the Egyptians are very sensitive to the Turkish problem. They regard it as a problem. Remember, they were under Turkish rule for many years, under Ottoman rule, and subsequently became independent, only with the help largely of the British and to a lesser extent Italians and other Europeans. Right now, Sisi is seen as a quote-unquote Jewish-American puppet who is simply there to suppress Islamist elements and to keep everything quiet and prevent Egypt from joining the ranks of those Islamic nations and peoples who are opposed to Israel's grand strategy to build a greater Israel. Well, that costs us a lot of money. The only state that receives almost as much money as Israel on an annual basis, in fact, it may be a little bit more at this point, is Egypt. And that money is vital. It's the money that is used to pay for the armed forces. It's money that's used to pay for housing and offset medical costs, all sorts of things inside that country. So he's been very reluctant to take a strident position against the Israelis for fear that we'll pull the rug out from under him. I think he's beginning to understand that the Saudis, the Emirates, and others in the world will come to his aid. But he's still very afraid. In the meantime, the population in Egypt, how do I put this? I think they are at a boil, frankly. The hatred for Israel and what is being done to the people that live in Israel, in Gaza, on the West Bank, is just stunning. It's overwhelming. And I think he really faces the grim possibility that he could be removed from power with all that being removed means. And then suddenly overnight, Egypt becomes a hotbed of hostility. And the Israelis are not unaware of this. I mean, you're talking about an intelligence service that's very competent, and the Israelis have looked at many, many alternatives for what they ought to do in the event that Sisi is removed. One of those is a contingency to actually move into the Sinai and seize control of the Suez Canal. The problem for the Israelis is largely one of manpower and resources. So they may actually go back and ask for the British and the French to assist them in seizing control of the Suez. This is a very touchy area. We've been down this road before.
That would be a pretty big geopolitical earthquake. I mean, how likely do you think it would be? Or maybe a better question is, what conditions would have to change or devolve, maybe a better word, that would make the British willing to take that kind of action along with Israel in the Suez Canal? That would be a big issue.
Well, I think if you had a government come to power or people come to power in Egypt who are similar to HTS in Syria, what works in Syria for British and U.S. interests may not work for British and U.S. interests in Egypt. In fact, I'm one of these people I keep trying to convince anyone who will listen that Syria's destruction and disintegration really is not a good thing. And that ultimately this will redound to the disadvantage of the Israelis and us. And we're sending more troops into Syria right now, as you know, and ostensibly for the purpose of retaining control of the oil and everything else. I think that if Sisi suddenly is removed and you get a new government, new leadership, military or otherwise, people are going to be very afraid because they're worried about the Suez. They don't want the Suez in the hands of powers that are hostile to the West. And I think whatever government comes to power in Cairo after Sisi will be very hostile to us and to the Israelis. The Israelis then would be tempted to move in, but they would clearly want British and French help. This time, in contrast to Eisenhower in 1956, declined to support that. I think at this point in time, I'm sure President Trump would probably say, that's fine if you want to do that. I don't think that's a good idea. And I think Israel is beyond overreaching. This is a headlong jump into the abyss, frankly. And the same conditions apply to Jordan. You've got to look at King Abdullah's position. He is very dependent on our largesse to keep his armed forces under control, to keep his officers paid. In all of these countries, it is our unnatural influence as a result of our willingness to spend money on things of no value or on things of no importance to us that has kept governments friendly to Israel. It's not working anymore, and it's going to vanish.
Well, and speaking of Israel and how they're maybe a bit overreached already, something in Egypt may not be the only thing they're thinking about doing. There's also some concern that before Trump gets inaugurated, so we're talking literally just two plus weeks from now, there's a possibility by many that Israel may strike Iran. In fact, there's this piece here in The Hill about 4 to 5 days ago, advocating exactly that. This is not the only one I've seen. They say, listen, this sets the stage for Trump administration to go beyond maximum pressure and target the heart of the Iranian regime. We've seen Bolton. We've seen Pompeo, Jack Keane. All these folks are harshly advocating for action by the United States. What is your concern that from Netanyahu's perspective, given his knowledge about how militarily overstretched they may be right now, to actually make good on that?
Well, Jim Cardin and I wrote a piece entitled America's Next War of Choice, Iran, and tried to essentially answer your question. So I would invite people to go to the American Conservative and find that article, because it's going to provide more detail than I can here right now. But let's consider the following. If you're Mr. Netanyahu, you're in a very dangerous position. What do you do? Do you withdraw? Do you retreat? Do you fall back? Do you seek to consolidate what you have and cut a deal? No, because that would be fatal for him politically inside Israel. So what he's got to do is he's got to do more of what he's already begun, and that is spread the war. You know, I call Israel essentially now an arsonist state. It's burning down everything in sight, burning down Gaza, burning down the West Bank, burning down Lebanon. They're going to burn down as much of Syria as possible. They've just launched the largest air campaign in years against Syria, destroying targets all over the place. They think that they're accomplishing something. What they're accomplishing is the destruction of a status quo that they may not have liked, but they're setting the stage for the emergence of something much, much worse. And that was always the objection that we had to destroying Syria. Whatever you didn't like about Mr. Assad, next to the people that were positioned to replace him, he looked like Santa Claus. And right now, what you've got is a very dangerous group in Damascus. And by the way, they report to Mr. Erdogan. So effectively, the Turkish border has now been moved several hundred miles to the west to the Israeli border, wherever the Israelis are. And by the way, Mr. Erdogan has spoken very publicly and made his argument repeatedly that the Israelis cannot have any of the spoils of this war. In other words, he is not going to tolerate Israeli annexation of land. Now, that may not be possible immediately because the Israelis may decide that come hell or high water, they're going to stay there and retain it. But this is not a good thing for Israel because Israel thinks that by destroying Syria, they've opened the pathway to attack Iran without interruption or disruption. They may discover that Syria now is even less hospitable than it was before. And I know that the Turks are planning on bases in and around Damascus to include substantial air and missile defenses. None of that is going to be good for Israel, in my judgment. So yeah. I think he has to say, do I wait for President Trump to show up? Do I risk the possibility that President Trump looks at this disaster, finally realizes it's a catastrophe, and says, I don't want to play. I really want a deal, even though the probability of him getting a quote-unquote deal at this point in the region is pretty slim. My limited exposure to President Trump, and I like him, as you know, I feel great affection for him, is this is not a man of war. This is not someone who wants war. I think Mr. Netanyahu knows that. So if you're Netanyahu, what do? I think you pull the trigger and get into it now. The same thing applies in Iran. I think he's worried that the Iranians will have nuclear warheads that can be mated with missiles very shortly, in which case Israel's monopoly on nuclear power ends very quickly. I don't think Mr. Netanyahu wants that to happen. So those two considerations drive me to the conclusion that Mr. Netanyahu has got to get the war started with Iran as soon as possible.
And if that happens, one of the big vulnerabilities to the United States is our troops in Syria, which we've been arguing should have been out long ago, 2019 at the latest, after the ISIS had lost their territorial acquisitions, but we've remained them there. Well, this recent, and the last thing I want to cover here, in this recent terrorist attack in New Orleans, where someone who had been radicalized, a former American soldier, had been radicalized in pro, had an ISIS flag and several other things. Predictably, there are those in the United States that want to seize on that as an opportunity to make sure we get our teeth deeper into Syria. Watch this.
When America fails to lead, when you don't engage in solid law enforcement and enforcing criminal laws, when you can't secure your borders, when you refuse to call out radical Islamic terrorism and punish it, you get the events of October 7th. You get the events of just this past week in New Orleans. You get a resurgence of ISIS. You get Al-Qaeda back growing again after what happened in Afghanistan. This is a set of failed policies that lead directly to increased risks all across America, in our cities and all across this country. I fear not only are there folks who are members of ISIS or inspired by ISIS, as we saw, but there are planners, there are plants, there are people who might well be activated. This is the task that President Trump and his team will face. They need to go find them all, take down these networks through the solid intelligence collection, right? This is hard work collecting chatter from abroad and things that are taking place inside the country. It is granular grunt work that's got to be done and executed by the federal officials, by local and state sheriffs and police forces. But it needs to be led by the United States of America from the top.
Now, in the setup to that commentary there by Pompeo, the Fox anchor had literally connected everything that had been associated with ISIS over several years to what's going on here, and saying that, yeah, we've got to go after them. And you see Pompeo just trying to deepen that thought there. What would happen to the United States if we do deepen our hold in Syria? And what would happen if we take them out of Syria, as you advocated in Poland and elsewhere?
Well, keep in mind that Secretary Pompeo, when he was head of the CIA and later on as the Secretary of State, was very much in favor of supporting ISIS and its offsprings in terms of al-Nusra and other terrorist organizations that were descendants of al-Qaeda. He bankrolled that. He supported it in Syria. These are the people that have now taken over in Syria. So on one side of his mouth, he's saying that we should join the Israelis in an all-out war against Islam in the entire region. And at the same time, he's one of the arsonists who's helped to light the fires that have brought down not just the government in Syria, but have helped to create chaos across the Middle East. So one has to take, whatever he says with a grain of salt. Understand that he's very much a creature of the Israel lobby. He's a recipient of enormous quantities of money and donations for backing everything and anything that is what Mr. Netanyahu wants, war with Iran and so forth. Finally, there's no understanding of the consequences of our actions. What we've done in Syria, what is likely to happen in Egypt, and what will precipitate the war with Iran, that whatever the Israelis come up with, ultimately we're going to end up in a situation where millions of people are going to be harmed. There's going to be enormous damage done to us and as well as to Israel. Israel may not even survive this because the hatred is just overwhelming at this point. And we are then isolated from the rest of the world because the Russians and the Iranians now allegedly have a mutual defense pact in place.
Yeah,
Russia is not going to stand by and watch us destroy Iran.
That is so ironic, if not outright perverse, that so many in the United States, especially who are supporters of Israel, think that by cheering them on in these military conquests, that they think this is going to accomplish something, that it will bring peace and security to Israel. But as you point out, and if we had more time, we could certainly go into it even more, it's almost certainly planting seeds of disunity and also of insecurity that they may not be able to handle later on. But we'll have to leave it right there for the time being. We'll certainly continue to follow that. Thank you so much for joining us today, Doug. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Okay. Thank you, Dan.
Bye-bye. And we'll just ask you guys to just watch, because here literally just minutes from now, we're going to have Aidan Menis, who was a former British person who's working, fighting on the Russian side. He's going to talk about what's going on there. We've had people on the Ukraine side who have fought for the Ukraine, who have been pro on that. We like to balance things out. We're going to hear from the other side. Join us real quick, 2 p.m. We'll see you on the next episode of Daniel Davis Deep Dive.